This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Stephen Klasko. Dr. Klasko is the CEO and president of Jefferson Health. He's done simply a remarkable job with the great team of building Jefferson Health into one of the elite health systems in the United States. It's both elite in academic medical center and does a tremendous job of taking care of its communities. Dr. Klasko, can you take a moment to introduce yourself?
Yeah, first of all, thank you, Scott. I feel like I should end with that. But I'm Steve Klasko. I have an interesting background. I'm an obstetrician who actually started my career as a DJ and has had the opportunity to be the dean of a few different medical schools. And now I have the honor of leading the fourth largest medical school university and now the largest health system in Philadelphia called Jefferson Health.
Take a moment on how skills as a DJ are transferable to skills as a CEO.
Well, I could do the everything I learned is 70s music, but I think really when you think about it, a lot of what you're doing as a DJ is communicating with folks, and you're having to communicate in a way where you're not directly across from them. So, you know, think about the pandemic, Scott. I have 35,000 employees. And I have people that are scared, and we have three values at Jefferson: put people first, do the right thing, and be bold and think different. And I had to communicate with those 35,000 people around how we were adhering to those values and how we were going to take care of them without necessarily being right next to all of them. It's not a whole lot different than trying to set the tone for a radio show or any kind of communication across a wide band. So I've used that a lot. I've also, Scott, had the opportunity to think about 70s music. So things like Tired of Being Alone by Al Green. I think, you know, I really talked about that and used that song as we're getting our university back together of that balance. I Want a New Drug by Huey Lewis in the News. We're actually one of the places that's developing a vaccine. We have a vaccine called Coronavax, which is getting into phase two trials. And then the one that I've really actually put on some of my Friday letters to the staff is a great song by The Impressions called Choice of Colors. And I think given what's going on with our reawakening of racial injustice, and we're dealing with a lot of that here at our university, listening to some of that music, I think really helps that people realize this is a new discussion that we're having.
Thank you. And take a moment and talk about Jefferson Health. I've been incredibly impressed at just the growth in digital, the team building, the putting together of systems and making them work, and just your great job in developing other leaders. But let me stop. Let me ask you to talk about two or three of the things you're particularly proud of at Jefferson Health.
So when I went to Wharton, I had a professor of leadership that gave me some great advice, Scott. He said, you should always have five people under you that think they can do a better job than you and three that are right. And I've really taken that approach. I view myself as the orchestra conductor that can go out and really make some of the changes of what's going to be obvious 10 years from now and start to do them today in technology and AI and others. But I've hired amazing people to run our four pillars. We live on a four-pillar model: clinical and academic, what we call the old math, and innovation, strategic partners, and philanthropy, what we call the new math. So I think that's been one of the things that I'm most proud of. But the second thing is I really have tried to work with my team to take an approach of, let's look at what's going to be obvious 10 years from now. And even though it might cannibalize our current business, let's not be afraid of it. So we invested in telehealth, Scott, in 2013, about $35 million, at one of the largest telehealth systems called Jeff Connect. It took us 5 years to get 100,000 patients through. We had 100,000 patients in Jeff Connect in 3 months during the pandemic. And we're doing other things like that with AI and looking at health assurance and getting healthcare out to home with some of our partners in Silicon Valley the same kind of way.
So we've had a chance to watch you and watch what you're talking about and invest in some of these things way before they became the norm. You also spend a lot of time now on what healthcare will look like 10 years from now. You were way ahead of the curve in some of your thinking. Tell us now how you see things 10 years from now so that we could start to look at that together as to what the world will look like in healthcare 10 years from now.
Sure. So I think, you know, I think when there's a pandemic in 2030, we'll laugh and cry about what happened in 2020. Because at the end of the day, if you think about it, Scott, your car gets better care than you do today. Your car might be in the garage sending continuous signals. And when you wake up, you might say, Scott, while you were sleeping, my right passenger tire got a little low. Could you fill it up? We still have a concept called physicals, where literally once a year or once every 2 years, we go and say, today your blood pressure is X, your heart rate is Y, your EKG is Z, and this is what you should do for the next 2 years. So the future that we're working on, and we're working with colleagues, a colleague from General Catalyst, Haymont Tanasia, who is now embedded into Jefferson, a venture capital group that started Livongo and Airbnb, and Warby Parker and others. But we're literally looking at a future where you will go to sleep with a wearable. And when you wake up and say, hey, I want to listen to the Becker's podcast to your Alexa, they'll say, well, before you do that, Steve, you have asthma and your respiratory rate was a little labored. Please take an extra inhaler. So that literally healthcare, like everything else, will start at home. And what that means for the traditional healthcare ecosystem that you folks write about is that if this really is our Amazon moment, and if you're a healthcare provider and you think you can exist on heads and beds, that's not going to work. If you're an insurer and you think that you can continue to make ridiculous profits by making sure that people that pay for the care get the care and provide the care can't talk to each other, that's not going to work. If you're a pharma that's depending on retail prices, you're going to have to provide the kind of consumer service that other areas have had to provide. I don't want to be Sears and Penny's when the revolution comes. I don't mind being Target and Walmart because they were able to do to look at both the E part of it and also what they do in their main stores. I think for us, it'll be the same way. If somebody has pancreatic cancer, they need to come to Jefferson and get the best care. But we also need to be, I want not patients, but people to view Jefferson as their partner of how they can thrive without health getting in the way.
And take a moment on the new book that you authored. Talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. And you know, it's my fifth book, and most of my books are science fiction books because it keeps me from going nuts having to run a healthcare system in this time. But this book is written with an individual named Haymont Tanasia, who I mentioned before. Haymont has been an incredibly successful entrepreneur as the managing principal of General Catalyst, and got into healthcare in a big way by initially investing in Livongo, which has done an incredible job of bringing AI into diabetes care. So the book starts out, Scott, so a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and a CEO of a 195-year-old academic medical center walk into a bar, start dating, and sort of what would that look like professionally if that were to happen? And that's exactly what happens. We're embedding General Catalyst into our DICE group, Digital Innovation and Consumer Experience. We're bringing our folks out to Silicon Valley. So we're marrying the two worlds. So it's not like what happened with the EMRs where we'll develop them over here and then we'll sell them to you, or what happens when you go to HIMSS and 870 people are trying to sell you something. This is how can we bring all of our resources and technology and AI into helping you solve your problems. And so the category of health assurance is a category of consumer-centric, data-driven healthcare services that are really designed to bend the cost curve of care and help us stay well, starting at home. And then one more thing, Scott. What I'm even more excited about that, together with Haymont, I'm a fellow of the World Economic Forum in Davos, and I co-lead the platform on digital economy. We're starting a Center for Responsible Innovation. If you think about it, back in the Industrial Revolution, if we knew that the internal combustion engine would cause climate change, we might have made some changes. If we knew that the social media revolution, I think what's going on with the tech giants now and the testimony has made that really clear. If we knew it was going to be more than just seeing your grandkids on Facebook, we might have made some changes if we knew it would affect elections as you hate. We are now in a fourth industrial revolution of AI, drones, robotics, 3D printing, genomics. And we're really, really pushing to put ethics at the very beginning of that, put disparities at the beginning of that, make sure that this technology is not just used to make the wealthy healthy, but to get over the embarrassment in Philadelphia, for example, of a 21-year life expectancy discrepancy by zip code. And we saw that with the pandemic also. So the concept of the Center for Responsible Innovation is how can a place like Jefferson and a place like General Catalyst work together to really bring this AI in to reduce disparities, to start moving social determinants into the mainstream, to make sure there's real privacy when we start to get into genomics. Because we frankly can't trust the Googles, the Facebooks, the Amazons, and others to do it. This needs to be a partnership between the traditional healthcare ecosystem and the outsiders.
Thank you. And it's a fascinating world that we live in. I mean, we wake up in a spot where one of the social media giants is in threat of getting closed down by the government, you know, and it's fascinating because partly the government doesn't do a very good job of explaining why often they have these concerns, and the concerns may be merited or not merited, but they're not well explained. Take a moment, Dr. Klasko, on you've been through this really unusual period of time in Philadelphia and in the country with COVID-19, with the changing of revenue models, with the new reemergence of discussions of racial justice and health equity and so forth. You've built remarkable teams at Jefferson. You mentioned the Dice Group in your last discussion, which is really a model for the nation in terms of building an innovation and digital team. Talk about your top three priorities the next 6 months. What do you view as the top priorities the next 6 months?
Well, look, I think back to our 70s music, I think Staying Alive by the Bee Gees would be a good one. But one of the things, and Scott, you and your publication have been a leader around looking at health policy and how that affects all of us. But I really want to be a voice in changing health policy. I think that one of the things that we've missed is that the Affordable Care Act literally did a great job of giving more people access to a broken, fragmented, expensive, and inequitable system. And hoped that we would transform. And back in the 90s, one of my mentors, a guy named Bill Kissick, wrote a book called Medicine's Dilemmas, Infinite Needs, Finite Resources. He was the first one to talk about the iron triangle of access, quality, and cost. You increase access, you have to increase cost or decrease quality, unless you're willing to disrupt the system. And he said back in the 90s, disruption is painful. If anybody tells you they're going to increase access, increase quality, and decrease cost, and it's not going to be painful, can't be true. So if you think about the ACA, what was said by President Obama is this will increase access, increase quality, decrease cost, and it won't be painful. That can't be. You know, I think President Trump's has been terrific, fantastic, unbelievable, and huge. But the fact is we have to start to look at that transformation in a very different way. If you just read your articles and Becker's, you know, Mayo Clinic furloughs, cuts hours of 30,000 employees to help offset $3 billion in pandemic losses. COVID-19 pushes Cleveland Clinic to a $40 million operating loss in quarter one. AHA report, hospital financial losses from COVID-19 expected to top $323 billion in 2020. At the same time that articles have been United Health Group's second quarter with a net profit of $6.6 billion, twice what it was the year before. Centene's profit grows to $1.2 billion during the pandemic quarter, more than double, et cetera, et cetera. We have an incredibly fragmented system that has really not done what it needed to do for the people that need it most. During the pandemic, folks in underserved areas, African-American folks, underrepresented minorities, died at a much greater degree than others. And it wasn't because of any genetic differences. It was because of the social determinants of health. So I want to use my 40 years of bully pulpits and really starting to look at how we can affect health policy. That's number one. I think from Jefferson's point of view, we need to double down on diversifying our portfolio. So we will always do a great job of teaching students. We've moved 3,000 courses online. We're doing a hybrid approach. We have a 160-page handbook for our students coming back. We have 14 hospitals. I'm incredibly proud of our team. We were prepared for the pandemic as far as PPE. We've had one of the lowest employee infectivity rates. But at the end of the day, we can do all that, and we did all that, and we had a financial tsunami. So we need to diversify our assets and really start to contribute to that $1 trillion that's going to be spent in healthcare transformation. So I want to double down on our strategic partnerships, our relationships with partners. And then I want to start to solve some of the systemic problems. We have a product that we co-developed called Strongline, which is basically looking at nurse safety. When you think about nurses stuck in rooms with patients, and they're still calling code oranges and hoping somebody will come. This is just a simple GPS device that literally has somebody come within 20 seconds. So I want to really start to look at how technology and the fourth industrial revolution can start to solve some simple problems, just like Amazon started with selling books in a more efficient way, and then literally be one of the, frankly, revolutionaries of having 90% of healthcare happen at home. You know, I look at banking. None of us gets up in the morning and says, I think I'm going to telebank this morning. It's just that 90% of banking went from the bank to the home. I believe we'll have some kind of transformation like that. I think it's time for consumers to have their I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And I'm hoping that Jefferson will be ready for that kind of disruption.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Klasko. And I love your thoughts. I do want to touch on one thing so the audience doesn't mishear it. There's one issue of, look, even if we have Medicare for all or Medicaid for all, and not a plus or minus on it, but that itself doesn't solve the access problem. It solves the issue of making sure everybody has coverage, but we still need enough providers, enough digital, enough everything to make sure people actually get the coverage they want, they actually get the care they want, not just coverage, two different things. You had mentioned health insurance profits combined with health system losses at a time when health systems are doing yeoman's work, I mean, incredible work throughout our country in improving daily in how they care for COVID patients and take care of their own employees. I want to point that out. You also said something about how President Obama, even though directionally correct in trying to make sure we had coverage for everybody, didn't have it completely correct. And then you also said, but largely applaud the effort to get coverage for people, but understanding that coverage will, you can't have that without more cost, and you also need to improve access. So overall complementary of the direction. Then you made a sort of a joke about President Trump being fantastic and huge and all those kinds of things, and I think you meant that in jest, and I just want to make sure that our audience is clear about that.
I have publicly suggested that we have a 9/11 commission for healthcare, that both the Democrats and the Republicans, the Democrats have tried under President Obama, but again, it's provided access to a fragmented system, and the pandemic proved that. And the Republicans, frankly, had said that they would look at something, but not much has happened. So that wasn't just. But I mean, another way to look at it.
I just want to make sure people don't take that out of context, right, as you use President Trump's own superlatives in a joking way to praise his leadership, and you mean that in complete jest, and I want to make sure people understand that. That was my point.
I mean, I think, to me, the sum total of that was, you know, don't worry, it's going to be terrific and huge, and someday you'll see it, yes. And I think the other way to look at it is when you think about Senator Sanders, he was 100% right about the problem that we have a fragmented, expensive, and inequitable system that's literally driven by corporate profits. I think the pandemic proved he was 100% wrong about the solution of just let government run it. So what I believe will happen, Scott, and what I would hope we'd start to see enlightened leadership on, is really start to incent folks for taking care of everybody and improving access across the entire system. So literally, you know, I think there's an Upton Sinclair quote I like to use. It's hard to get somebody to do something when their salary depends upon them not doing it. The fact is that we have to take population health out of an academic framework and into the mainstream. We have to take predictive analytics. We have to take some of the other things that we can do of making healthcare less expensive and democratize it so that we can literally get this out to everybody. And then we have to figure out some way of having some kind of strategic alignment between whatever insurers are going to bring to the table and providers, because we should never be in a situation again where literally health systems are going to have to go bankrupt or lay off folks while the folks in the middle are doing well, or vice versa. It just shouldn't be like that in
the people in the middle, in part because of capitated systems, are in some ways just cleaning up because they've been providing less payment for lots of services that got sidelined for this period of time, and it creates a very strange paradox and paranoid. I want to take one moment on candidate Sanders or former candidate Sanders or Senator Sanders. The fascinating thing about Bernie Sanders is, whether he's right or wrong on the solution, he probably does a better job of any politician in the last couple of decades of clarifying two of the big problems we have, which are the cost of health care, if not the cost of health care, the lack of coverage for people, and also the cost of higher education. And so Sanders, and obviously, you know, my politics are naturally not where Senator Sanders' politics are, but what he is clearer and more right, as you mentioned, about two of the problems facing our country than any other politician over the last couple of decades. And it's partly why it resonates so well with people, the cost of higher education. Undergraduate education has become insane in our country. The cost of health care and the lack of coverage for certain people has been pointed out brilliantly by him, and it's been a debacle through this period of the pandemic. It's been a debacle for some time. But it's a fascinating thing to look at, because he actually hits a couple issues more clearly and more right than almost anybody else does, even if you and I don't agree with his solutions to them, which I think we don't. But it's
right. And I think the other thing is he's been consistent. You know, it's funny you mentioned that, both academics and healthcare, because in 2013, when I started at Jefferson, Scott, I had given a talk, and the guy before me was Austin Goolsbee, who you know, and he was saying about the two things that are going to go through the biggest disruption you don't want to be leading for the next 10 years are academics and healthcare. and I started my talk, darn, I just took a job in academic healthcare. But both of those suffer from a non-consumer centric. I mean, I think we're seeing it in universities now, where 90 or 100% is online, and parents are looking and saying, now let me get this straight. You're spending $60,000 for this when you could get a massive open online course from Southern New Hampshire University for one-tenth of that price. You know, so I think, yes, I think that's going to be disrupted. And I think Senator Sanders really pointed to the problem. And that was, if you really believe the Affordable Care Act was going to work, and you believe you were going to take a dollar and a quarter of healthcare and move it down to a dollar so everybody could get access, you would have sold all your middleman stocks, because that's what happened when Amazon came in retail or Uber came in, or they basically made it more efficient. Well, that would have been a mistake, at least investing wise, because, you know, corporate insurers went up by about 10 times since the ACA, pharma, supply chain companies, even PBMs, all succeeded very well. So how can the middle expand 5 or 7 times, not increase costs, and provide people more access? That gets into that impossible iron triangle again that nobody's wanted to deal with. Healthcare, Scott, is not that complicated. It's just that you have to have the profiles of courage to make the kind of changes that need to happen that will not make some people happy.
And this would include, I mean, obviously we need lots of new providers, new physicians, new nurses, new everything, more digital, more everything. And somebody's got to, at some point, figure out the exact place of the insurance companies and all of this, and where exactly they sit and what the role is, because it's a fascinating situation. It really is. Anyways, Dr. Klasko, I could talk to you all day. You've done an absolutely remarkable job at Jefferson Health, really remarkable, and just a fascinating, creative, and intelligent, a mind that mixes the ability to be extremely smart and to execute on priorities and build great teams. So you've just a remarkable job, and I want to thank you for joining the Becker's Healthcare Podcast today. Just a pleasure visiting with you.
Thank you, Scott. If I could leave you with one thought, it would be this. As we move to a technologic revolution, instead of Medicare for all, broadband for all. Broadband should be like electricity and plumbing, because then everything becomes possible that we talked about for the last half hour.
Well, and it's so funny you say that, because right now we talk about remote learning in some places, in certain urban environments, certain rural environments. There is no remote learning because there is no broadband. And
right.
So
and
you can't even get to the next step without fixing that issue. And your point is very well taken.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate that.